Hello, my name is Woody. This is Change in the House of Pods, a podcast about Deftones. My guest today is Fred Crochelle. First things first, let me tell you, I am honored, humbled, and simply delighted to share this conversation with you. Fred's worked with some of the biggest names in the music business. Michael Jackson, Pearl Jam, Madonna. And you'll hear Fred talk about Madonna a little towards the end of our conversation, and he's got a Pearl Jam story that's fun to think about, too. But when you hear him speak, I think you're going to understand why I'm so stoked to share this conversation with you. This man radiates an infectious love of music, and he's got a deep, deep love for Deftones. Fred was a GM at Maverick Records. He's going to help us paint a more complete picture of what life was like at Maverick. He's going to talk about the people who worked there. He'll explain how, thanks to the success of Alanis Morissette and Jagged Little Pill, Maverick was afforded the opportunity to build out their staff and operate more autonomously, independent of Warner Brothers. And that was crucial for Deftones. Fred will explain why. They really built a label from the ground up, Fred and the Maverick team. And there were only a handful of people over Fred in the Maverick hierarchy. So for me, this conversation was as educational as it was fun. I hope you'll find that too. Next week, my guest will be Danielle Parsons, a brilliant photographer and one of the most generous people I've ever met. She helped me connect with a couple of different folks who will be on the pod this season. Jeremy Bohm from Touche Amore and Mercy, who's become one of my new favorite artists. She's a solo artist, but she's also the singer for Fleshwater, which is a project with members of Vane. By the way, spoiler alert, Fleshwater, working on new songs. Super dope band. If you haven't checked them out, I highly recommend. All right, please enjoy my conversation with Fred Crochelle. He's hosted Deftones at his home for Super Bowl parties. He said the guys love his wife's cooking, and there's an amazing photo of him on my Instagram page if you haven't seen it yet. I'm at Woodbruh, W-O-O-D-B-R-U-H, on Twitter and Instagram. The photo is of Fred and Chino and Abe and Frank and Darren Eggleston. Fred said they were at a gold plaque party for Around the Fur. Abe and Chino appear to be holding bowls of alcohol. It looked like they were having a pretty good time, too. And speaking of plaques, when I hopped on Zoom with Fred, he was in his office, and it's wall-to-wall plaques. I mean, all kinds of platinum records. You can tell he has accomplished a ton in the music industry. So my first question for him was, what do you do now?
I left Maverick at the end of 2002, and I'm sure we're going to talk about my time there with the Deftones. But in 2003, I started my own company, Crochelle Entertainment Group. We're a management and a marketing company. So we manage a few artists now. And, you know, on the marketing side, we're very well known for taking all my past, you know, experience of, you know, working at the labels for years. And what we're noted for is really helping artists that want to have their own labels. So we've established their own independent labels for Filter, Everlast, Blind Melon, Smokey Robinson, Jackson Browne, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Bonnie Raitt, Herb Alpert. It really kind of spans all genres. And, you know, small independent labels that were just getting started, for example, have no infrastructure. And they'll hire my company to be the infrastructure. For example, there's a brilliant A&R person by the name of Josh Deutsch, made records for years. You may have know the name, you know, signed some real notable artists. And he started a label in 2006 by the name of Downtown Records. And it was him and one finance guy. He hired my company to be the infrastructure. And the first record we did was Eagles of Death Metal, sold 100,000 records. So you would say, wow, we got him on the map. That's a good thing. But the next one was a grand slam. It was Gnarls Barkley. And at 500,000 units, we took it from being independent, which we had, you know, three formats at radio, and we're fucking rocking. And he had a chance to come clean with all his investors and sell it, upstream it to Atlantic Records. So the first 400, 500,000 units, or as I like to say, the 0 to 75 miles an hour, we did. And then Atlantic took it to like 3.5 million copies. But they did give me a platinum record that's on somewhere here. So, you
That's
know,
amazing. Is that pretty?
But yeah, artists come to us all the time. For example, Ryan Adams was the most recent who has an independent label. And people are always asking questions because for the last 17 years in the independent space, we've released records that have, you know, charted on the Billboard charts, sold hundreds of thousands of units. And people go, what's the name of that label? And then they find out, oh, it's the artist label. Well, we're behind it. And we don't mind being, you know, the company behind the curtain. We're paid for a service to know how to sell, market, and promote. We don't make the music because people go, what do you do? And I said, well, we don't play an instrument. We don't sing into a mic. We don't twist knobs in a studio. But I said, when we get it in our hands, we know what to do. And that can involve, you know, some of the artists that I mentioned. It can involve, they left a label after many years, need a website, photo shoots, video shoots, video promotion, hiring the radio team. All of the projects are uniquely different. Some don't go to radio necessarily, right? Some just want a streaming strategy and proper distribution. But the mission statement has always been that it's the artist, not mine. So people will go, Fred, what's the name of your label? I go, no, it's the artist label. For example, Jackson Brown has been a client for 16 years. His label's called Inside Recordings. It's distributed by ADA, and we oversee everything about that for him. So he'll have a big record release in June of next year. We have a team of like 10 publicists worldwide because he's a worldwide artist. And he's sold about 1.5 million records independently. And for the artists that really understand the model, they love the creative control. They love the ability to make more money per album, per stream, per everything. It goes right to them. Mm. They understand the flip side of that is that they have to pay for somebody like me and my experience, right? And they have to pay for a publicist. They have to pay for a photo shoot, any hard costs. And for our management clients, the ability to know all these things on the marketing side has proven in the last 5 years that managers, traditional managers, really were behind the eight ball and needed to understand a lot of what I already knew.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do it knowingly when I came up through the label ranks, but, you know, head of marketing, a vice president of sales worldwide at Columbia Records before I even came to Maverick. So I had been an executive for 12 and a half years at that time. So I came in to Maverick, there was only 10 people on staff. They didn't even have departments. They were attached to the mothership. And we'll get into that about the Deftones because it's really a unique story, an exciting story about what we tried to get them to pay attention. And because of them and others, we ended up building our own infrastructure, see, and separating a bit from the mothership.
What do you mean when you say we tried to get them to pay attention? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, with the Deftones, you know, they were, record came out in 95. I came in 96. And even before I started, you know, the powers that be at Maverick put me on the phone with the head of WEA, and they were explaining the situation about not enough records, what was happening with Adrenaline was the band was going into a city. They were selling like 3,000 records. I'll use Cleveland as an example. And you'd see like in the next week, it would go to like 200 and then it would go back to 3,000. And this pattern, you know, I had been very experienced at the point of coming in already. That pattern told me there wasn't enough inventory out in the marketplace. right? People couldn't get it. And you'd see a cycle of, oh, they ordered more and then it came back in, sales went up. So I came in and the first thing I did was I said, let's discount it, discount adrenaline to every account. Let's put some advertising money, whether that be on radio or whatever, with these accounts, make them feel more secure, bring in, take the risk on, let's go, let's stock up. And Warner Brothers, getting back to Warner Brothers, they were like, hey, Adrenaline sold 50,000, you know, the band's great live, but call it a day, get them into the studio. And I was like, no way. We're not stopping the foundation at 50,000. So we continued to spend money, support them on the road, which allowed Adrenaline, our final break point in between Around the Fur, was 250,000. Much, much larger imprint. But Warner Brothers, we even went over, myself, Freddie DeMann, Guy O'Siri, Darren Eggleston, who you've had on the show, and Terry Insaldo, who ran promotion at Maverick. And at that point, Warner Brothers, I see now they're affiliated with Reprise, but the Warner Brothers radio team was in there, and they were trying to give us excuses about this, that, and we were like, the time is now. Go for it. Let's go after radio. And we just, once again, we kind of left the Warner Brothers meeting a little bit down because they weren't really into making the Deftones a priority. Once again, if you really understand it, Maverick Recording Company was a joint venture. So we had to go to what I refer to as the mothership. And based on priorities, ability to work things at radio, they decide whether, oh, Deftones is Warner Brothers, Alanis Morissette is Reprise. So Alanis Morissette having such success allowed us to build our own radio team and really take control of ourselves. Does that make sense?
Alanis Morissette's success, you said, allowed you to make your own radio team.
Yeah, it did. And staff up in other areas. You know, that's where we could really, our own marketing team, our own press team. Those things were done over in Burbank at Warner Brothers. So you almost had to kind of, dare I use the term, lobby a little bit on behalf of your artists. But I have to give credit where credit's due. With the influx of the money from Alanis, Freddie DeMann had the insight to, you know, staff up. And that's why I was even hired. And I was an executive that had managed, you know, 100 plus people within the Sony system. So I came in and before too long, we had our own departments. We didn't have to necessarily go, hey, will you please work this, for lack of a better, you know, and we could control our own destiny. And that was really important to the success, I think, of Deftones and others, you know.
What was it, just the sales and the patterns that you saw in the numbers that Adrenaline was doing? Like you said, 3,000 one week, a couple hundred. Was that sales pattern what ultimately was the indicator to you? Like, we need to take our time with this?
Yeah, I'll speak to that. You know, every artist does travel a different pathway. And, you know, sometimes it's, you know, a video. Sometimes it's a song at radio. With the Deftones, like, make it very clear, it was all about the live performance, the reaction. The fans were just fanatical. That's what they were. And, you know, you could see it because we would do some in-store signings and some in-store, you know, around the country. and these independent record stores were getting trashed. People were out of their minds, right? And you would literally, back in the day, you'd sell like 500 albums in one day, 500 CDs. And the guys, you know, were willing participants because they love their fans. And, you know, to this day, it's a tribute to them how, you know, 25 years later, how much their fans love them.
I'm a perfect example of that. Do you think too that that might be what separates them from other artists that were emerging at that time? Because maybe this is jumping the gun a little bit, but I am interested in your insight in terms of what was going on in the music industry, specifically within the rock and alternative genres, and then how the bubble was bursting with the internet and ultimately, and new metal particularly, how that really oversaturated. It seemed like this perfect storm of things for bands to just fall off of the earth, and they didn't. So I'm really curious.
I have strong feelings about that. You got to remember that MTV was super strong, right? And you got to remember, without really throwing any bad light towards alternative radio, because it was really the heyday of alternative radio. But it was also a hit machine, if you know what I mean. You know, the thing about a hit machine is the lack of longevity. You know, you shine something up, you make a real glitzy video, and here today, gone tomorrow. So the Deftones were certainly separate because their foundation was built on live performance, fan strength, right? And, you know, it really kind of leads me into, because I want to answer your question. The separation for them was that they weren't being accepted by MTV. They weren't being accepted on an overall by radio. I have to give props to K-Rock in LA for knowing and understanding that what the Deftones had brewing over there was going to be something that was going to be big, just like we knew it was going to be big, based on fan reaction. And, you know, even though there was sparse airplay, you know, in the late 90s, leading up to, of course, White Pony, without it being a methodology or strategic, it just was natural growth. So on Around the Fur, we had a couple of videos that MTV toyed with a little bit because they knew stuff was real. And in the artist community, everybody was going, whoa, Deftones are the shit. Oh my God, you got to see this band live. They are the shit. And so, you know, I would say it really comes back to credibility, right? Because if your foundation is, wow, that's a really slick song. Wow, that's a cool video. Guess what? You got to keep coming with the slick video. You got to keep feeding the machine. That was never and still isn't the Deftones. So I don't know if that answered your question, but I hope.
Yeah. It certainly does. And I wonder too about the artist with the slick videos and the hit songs that didn't, you know, build it the way that Deftones did. They all came out like, man, there was so many from 98 to two, like it was just a lot. So many that to me, I'm sort of showing my cards as a new metal fan, like it gets trashed. That genre gets trashed all the time because of how oversaturated it was. And because, you know, they're like Fred Durst was a caricature of himself at the end of the day. But I still love that band. And I still think the first four or five bands that you think of from that genre, the Korn, Deftones, Limp Bizkit, Linkin Park, I still think they're all great. I wonder, where did all those resources, were the bands like the Cold Chambers and all those other bands that seemed to come out of the woodwork, were they allocated the same sort of resources, and did they, because the music industry was still pretty healthy and thriving, right? Like, how did those bands?
Well, you know, I think, well, I'll kind of jump to this. I think Deftones benefited, quite frankly, from Maverick being a small label that was controlled by, you know, an artist, Madonna. So I can safely say, you know, as a person that worked in that environment, that we always sided with the artist. So even though the Deftones was a losing proposition in the first few years, we kept feeding the machine because the fans were not going to be denied. You knew that it was real. You couldn't make up what would happen at these shows, the reaction. You couldn't make it up. It was very, very real. Now, I will say, you know, being at CBS Records, Sony Music for 12 and a half years prior, guess what? You have to think about whether you call it a luxury or not, Columbia Records, Epic Records, 30 records a month, right? So guess what? Oh, it's not working? Next. Conveyor belt mentality. Deftones benefited from being at Maverick because at Maverick, I felt like I learned to be a better marketer in so many ways because we only had like 5, 6, 7 releases a year.
Wow, really?
So that meant we spent money, we spent focus and attention on every record because we were not in the next game. So with the Deftones, we attached. When I say we attached, even though radio was slow to come over a few years, we still kept knocking on that door, kept pushing, had some great people, Darren, Terry, amongst others, that kept pushing that. And we also had, you know, an incredible street team presence. So that was a whole marketing plan where these independent stores were getting Deftones t-shirts and packages. And, you know, there was a cool element to that. We kept feeding that and feeding that so that, you know, you would start to see more and more 18 to 25 year olds wearing Deftones shirts. You knew that something was coming, right? And it was only a matter of time if you stuck with it. I don't know on a bigger label with multiple artists and multiple releases that they would have had the same opportunity. We just will never know that. But it really worked, and timing is everything.
Wow, that's amazing to think that you only released 5 or 6. How many people were at Maverick? What was Maverick like?
Maverick was incredible. One of my, you know, most favorite times in my career by far and away. And when I came in, like I said, there was maybe 10 to 15 people in total. Everything was farmed out in Burbank to the mothership. Right. Slowly over the course of a year, we kind of grew. I think at one point we actually grew to almost 100 people. So we had a robust radio team that did a great job. We had a press department. We had a sales department. We had a market. We were fully functional as a label. The energy was always very open. And I can speak to this having come from Sony, where there's some people, there's so many people that work in some of these larger labels. No fault of their own, just structurally how they're built is that, you know, some people in one department don't necessarily see others except for every Wednesday marketing meeting. Sure. Which, when you think about it, sounds absolutely crazy, right? Mm. So we were on top of one another. It was very open. And, you know, like if we were going to get a spin on K-Rock, you know, Terry, T-A as he's known, and Darren would be yelling, K-Rock's playing Deftones at 4 o'clock today. And then the sales team, the street team, everybody's like all over it. You know, there was an energy. What I'm trying to convey to you is it was infectious. It was artists came into our offices and loved to be there. This was an energy. This was not like going to a library. Let's go down this hallway into this cubicle and this person. There was fucking energy.
That's so cool. Where was Maverick? Where was it located?
So it was 8000 Beverly Boulevard at the very beginning when I started in 96. And then in a couple of years, we moved to Civic Center Drive right now, which is, we had the building that is now Live Nation in Beverly.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
So was there...
I can't even tell you how much energy was happening in that building.
Who do you think was the impetus for that? Like who brought that? Was it Guy? Was it Madonna? Was it Alanis? Like, where did that energy come from?
I think it really was a group effort. I think the chemistry just happened to be the group of people that was there together at the same time. You know, I feel proud to be a part of that. But, you know, I don't know if you've interviewed Terry, which you should. But TA was part of that. Darren was part of that. And like I said, it was very infectious. So, you know, the personalities of everybody were kind of let loose, right? We were living by the name Maverick. I mean, I don't even want to get into the conversations with corporate that we had where Madonna was so supportive of like better to beg forgiveness than to ask permission, just do it. Like with Deftones specifically, we were the first internet live broadcast, right? We were the first ones that were dealing with giving songs to the fans for free over the internet. Scared the living shit out of Warner Communications Company. What are you doing? Napster is this and that, like this. And we went into the new business before it was deemed as the new business.
Do you remember that, what the song was or what, how did that happen where you were?
Oh man, my phone's ringing. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. If you got to take it, well, I can always edit it.
WCEG. Okay. Sorry about that.
No, that's quite all right.
You know, it was really, little things that we did during Around the Fur, and it really culminated when we were going into White Pony, and we did this internet show on the Santa Monica Pier, and it was really cool. We made it a real event, a party, and the band played, and it was people on top of people, and we had an In-N-Out burger truck outside, and there was so much going on. But if you really take a look at the path, you know, 250,000 records with Adrenaline, never made it to the Billboard top 200 charts, never, right? Always on what was deemed as the Heat Seeker chart. So it was always bubbling under, right? And then Around the Fur comes out and debuts at number 29, right? Had never been on the Billboard Top 200. We sell like 40-something thousand units the first week. That's exciting. And then the third album, White Pony, in 2000, we sell 178,000 and debut at number 3. So if you see it, that's a pretty strong foundation from 95 to 2000. Yeah. And to be able to, you know, hang with those guys, party with those guys, celebrate with those guys, do a ton of in-store performances with those guys. For example, on Around the Fur, Darren and I flew to Salt Lake City the night that the record was released. They killed it in Salt Lake, sold out show. Then we went at midnight, which would be Tuesday morning, and they went to like 3 a.m. signing records, right? The next day they did the same thing in Denver. That whole week we had in stores every day. They showed up after performances. Saturday, I think they were at Long Beach and Tower, if I remember right. They then that night they played at the Palace with the Avalon here in LA, sold out show. And then it concluded up in Sacramento. But those in stores were like, it was driving press crazy. The sales were crazy. The energy was, like I said earlier, infectious.
What do you remember about the guys at that time?
Well, you know, they were, I'm 63. So they were, you know, a lot younger. They were young. They asked a lot of really good questions and they were really sweet. You know, I will say that sweet demeanors, all of them. And, you know, I think if you mentioned my name to them today, they would smile, you know, and rest in peace, Chi. We miss Chi. But, you know, it was a magical time. You know, I can't say that enough, a real magical time, because we were in it to win it together. You know, the label, you were rooting for them to break through, right? And on June 20th of 2000, I'll never forget, White Pony, you know, we went to dinner. There was a small dinner. And I remember toasting the band and saying, "Let's ride this pony for a long way." And we're in New York at Patsy's Italian restaurant. And we then drove in a van to do a midnight in-store. We stayed so long signing. And it was, once again, crazy energy that we drove back into the city from New Jersey from this store as the sun was coming up. Wow. And the band was going, "Yeah, we're going to bed." And I'm like, "I got a 9 o'clock meeting." And we then, that afternoon, it was a great day because that afternoon we went to MTV. They interviewed them live on MTV. They played the Change video and all of that. Then we went across the street to Virgin Megastore and they signed records all like that. And then I flew back to LA and passed out for like 12 hours, right? But it was, you know, fun stuff like that. And they always made it fun. They always did make it fun.
All of that stuff takes a ton of preparation and a ton of work and economic, financial support. There had to be then some idea of what was about to drop when on June 20th, 2000, like you had to know, the Maverick had to have this understanding of what was about to be released.
Well, if you look at it purely from a business standpoint.
Yeah.
The investment was made from the signing, from the inception of signing the band and building that foundation on what could be financially, you know, advantageous to everybody. You got to remember record one, 250, record two goes gold, but not all the way there. White Pony sells over 1 million records, right? Now you're talking, now you can see a profit based on your expenditures. That's the business side of it. But I will tell you, the emotional attachment by everybody at Maverick I can't say that enough. You really wanted to kill for these guys. Everybody, you know, it was, I've seen people rally around an artist many times over in my career, still do. But that group of people, all at Maverick, all just Deftones, everybody smiling. What can I do? What's going on? Attacking it for them, because it does take a lot of pre-planning. It takes a lot of execution, a lot of financial resources, but everybody really killed it for them. And I think they would absolutely say that, Woody.
That's incredible. And there were still only a handful of releases coming out of the label at that time.
When White Pony started growing in 98, 99, leading up to 2000. But they were, you know, by far and away just right with Alanis as a priority, you know?
Wow. And do you remember anybody else, any of the other artists that were?
We had Prodigy. We got into the soundtrack game, and that was very important as well, because we exposed the Deftones in that way too. We had them on the Matrix soundtrack, which we released in 99, highly successful. We released a track on the Little Nicky soundtrack. We had a deal going with Adam Sandler, where we were doing his soundtracks, Wedding Singer and all those early ones. And once again, another source of exposure for the band.
So is it fair to say, I apologize for interrupting, because you brought up Adam Sandler, and that really excites a particular memory that I have of the performance that they did on MTV for the Little Nicky film. Yeah. So it's fair to say then that you guys sort of orchestrated that by being
100%. Yeah. And the same thing with the Matrix soundtrack as well. You know, we were releasing that. Joel Silver, who was doing the movie, we came in last minute. It was so fast that was being put together. The whole track listing was put together by Jason Bentley, you know, who's a great guy as well. And he worked in our A&R department. And, you know, he put a Deftones song on there, and that record sold, you know, a few million. So, you know, once again, it's all about exposure that was building. And I don't like saying hitting a crest, but we knew come 2000 with White Pony that there was enough exposure, that the audience had grown. And dare I even say that some of the early fans probably were like, what are you doing? How are you taking phones away from me, man? It was like my hidden secret. Right. Now, like everywhere, you know? So that was a tough thing for, I think, a couple of the band members, but I can't do that.
I suppose you don't want to, you know, look like you're selling out, but at the same time, like, those opportunities. And I feel like Deftones fans over the years too have become a little bit more come one, come all, like just the more the merrier, you know what I mean?
Because of
that community, because of that, you know, building it on the road foundation. I feel like that's gotta be attributable.
There's so many things that I can refer to as stepping stones, you know, the soundtracks thing. K-Rock, what I mentioned earlier, you know, early, like being live remote at, you know, a couple of the in stores, right? Putting them on the side stage at the Weenie Roast, right? To then where they were on the main stage, right? At Anaheim Stadium. So, you know, seeing that whole spectrum grow, I hope you understand. I'm pretty excited when I think about that time.
Is there do you have any live show memories, any performance memories from Deftones that come to the top of mind that are just amazing, that blew you away? Anything that stands out?
Oh my God. You know, I mean, the show, the release week of Around the Fur, the show at the, you know, it's been called the Palace, Avalon, what have you. That was just, you know, phenomenal. But so many shows in New York as well, you know, Roseland and places like that. Just, you know, to me, I can't say anything stronger than when they do a live show, they just bring it each and every time. They attack it. They attack it. And that energy is why they have what they have, you know?
Is there an artist, you've been in the music business for a while, is there an artist from a previous era, whether it be a classic rock or any predecessor perhaps, that you can identify that has the same type of career path, the same sort of arc as Deftones?
You know, I never worked with them, but the one I would say closest to, and it's not really apples to apples, because, you know, I mentioned Warner Brothers, you know, and their big thing. They really stuck with a band by the name of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And that was three or four records in, you know?
Sure.
But those, I want to tell you, Woody, those stories that we're talking about, Deftones or Chili Peppers, they're few and far between. They're just the label's financial model, their ability to stick with a project for a very long time. And in the case of Deftones, years before it was profitable. I don't think those exist any longer in 2020. You know, so it's not an easy thing for me to answer that question when I think about who has built that arc, because it takes a lot of energy to stick with a band.
I know, that's why I asked it. I struggled to think about it, but now that you pointed out the Chili Peppers, it's like, yeah, that's a great example, because you know, their first few albums were not what their last few have been. It took a while for that growth.
You know, at a quicker pace, a band that I worked with, that I proudly have a plaque for their first record and worked with, and they would, you know, I'm sure Eddie would speak highly of me, is Pearl Jam. And, you know, I was running the Sony branch in Dallas as sales manager in Dallas. And we were the first branch to really kind of break out and sell and all of that. And the last in-store they ever did was for me in Dallas at a sound warehouse. But I remember the record coming out and sitting, and I remember going to Deep Ellum, and there were 50 people only at the show.
Wow.
And seeing, once again, that energy, that stage presence, you go like, man, this isn't going to be for long either. Now, their ascent happened a little bit faster than the Deftones.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, it's tough to think about somebody 3, 4, 5 year investment into a band before that bell rings.
So yeah, it's really fascinating to me. The career arc of this band is part of why, part of the reason that's motivated me to want to learn more about them, because it is so fascinating. You know, the build up from when their releases started coming out, but even then, prior to that, there's like 10 years of history that is largely undocumented. You know what I mean? There's some stories, but fewer videos, and that mystique really, it surrounds them, and it's fascinating and captivating to me. So it's cool to hear you dispel some of the, or just clear up some of these things about how and why their rise was what it was. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, once again, timing is everything, and magical is the only way I can describe it. But an entire company where I can honestly say every individual really like what's happening with the Deftones today, being focused, being so attentive, that part I've never seen on that big a scale, where everybody felt vested into helping them get to success.
That's so cool. If there was, if you were going to put together a celebratory Zoom call with those people, who could we get on the call?
Well, certainly I'd go through the radio team. There was quite a few that played a part in that. And Terry and Darren and Ted Volk and Gabby Skolnick as part of that. And certainly there's a gentleman that originally started the street team. His name is Danny Ornelas. And I'd bring him in, and I'd bring a guy by the name of Kenny Dedea in, who took over after Danny went to Columbia Records. And I would bring in Madonna's little brother, Mario, who also was very important in the street team and that marketing side of things. You know, there's others, you know?
Yeah.
On the internet side, there's Dave Newpert, who started our internet marketing division. Jeremy Welt, who then came in after and took it even to a greater level. On the marketing side, Barbara Bosman, who I had worked with at Sony, and a great, great marketing person, and others. It's really tough to go through, but it would be a great party. I promise you that.
I'm going to see what I can do. I think that's eye-opening, because you know there is a team, you know, but at the end of the day, you see the band and you have your CD or, you know.
I mean, as executives, you know, if I look over my head.
Yeah.
Oh, you got to think about Guy Osiri. You got to think about Freddie DeMann. You got to think about Ronnie Dashev, who really was instrumental in so many things at Maverick. She ran business affairs, and she also controlled all the finances. So, you know, there were a lot of conversations between she and I about the investment strategies, about, yeah, you know, we got to keep supporting these guys on the road. And, you know, look at those are important things to know along the way that people never get to take in account, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I talk about it all the time. There's a McDonald's that's actually it's closing in Dinkytown in Minneapolis. It's right by the radio station. And in 96, Deftones performed in that parking lot of that McDonald's, and that video, that grainy video that exists on the internet, has always been so fascinating to me because of all of those things that you just talked about. All those people had to somehow made that happen. Like, there was a very concerted effort to put Deftones in a McDonald's parking lot, and like you said, there are a lot of people involved that make that happen. And I do. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you for any kind of Madonna story. I'm a little miffed I didn't ask Dave, but just.
Well, I'll just tell you, extremely, extremely smart. Definitely somebody that does her research and reads, and an amazing, amazing person. I sat at her home and interviewed for over an hour, if this tells you anything. And she had a legal pad. She was pregnant with her first child, Lourdes, and just the deep amount of specific information in each question about my background and this and that, you would be blown away, because I was, you know. And I thought, okay, this is a meeting, this is an artist. You know, how much can she really dive down to in the sales and the marketing experience that I do, and distribution background? But she knows her shit. Now, this is a lady that if she's going to be on a panel on a talk show, she finds out every bit of information about the other panel guests, right? So she can be, you know, cool going in.
That's so really cool.
And the other thing is, she really was very respectful. A lot of people go, oh my God, how was that? Well, my experience was nothing but great. She was always very supportive and she listened. So, you know, whatever people may think, I think I know better that, you know, really smart, ambitious woman.
Wow, that's tremendous. That's so awesome. That's really cool. How I like to conclude every episode of the podcast is with a request for three recommendations. This is inspired by something Chino said on a podcast that he only tweets out links to YouTube music videos because he thinks that's the coolest thing that fans could get, that he could share with them, is music that he likes. So in that spirit, if you would give me three recommendations of absolutely any sort, these can be old, new, music, not music. It can be, I've had everything from alcohol to podcasts to books, a TED talk, whatever you like. Three recommendations, field is wide open. What would you put me onto?
Man, that is really tough. You know, I wish I would have known that going in. Some more thought. I'm just thankful beyond belief about, you know, not that my career is over, but the artists that I've worked with. And I think, you know, diving in to a few artists that I really know and love, and you could go into anything. I would have to say, you know, Michael Jackson. I would have to say Pearl Jam, right? And I would have to say Deftones.
So cool, man. Fred Crochelle. Huge thank you to Fred for spending time with me and sharing your part in the Deftones story. It's so cool to imagine Fred and Guy Osiri marching into Warner Brothers, demanding to keep Deftones out on the road and out of the studio to give Adrenaline more time to sell. I mean, to go from 50,000 to 250,000 albums sold, that's huge. And imagine if they'd been sent back into the studio right away. Around the Fur would be a completely different album. It might not have even been Around the Fur. White Pony might not have been White Pony. The effects of that are hard to grasp, but they really did fight for our guys. All of Maverick did. That's something Fred continued to emphasize via email after we spoke. They were a family at Maverick. I love that. I also loved hearing about the live stream in 2000 and how they gave away songs online and how Maverick got into the soundtrack game. That acoustic performance with Adam Sandler and Incubus, that wouldn't have happened otherwise. That was amazing, man. If anybody knows Adam Sandler, by the way, let him know. I'm available. I would love to talk about Deftones with him or anything at all. The Sandman's down, I'm down. The Change Pod is available on Spotify, Apple Pods, Google, Omni, TuneIn, iHeart. Please share it with your friends and come back next week for my conversation with photographer Danielle Parsons. My name is Woody. Thank you for listening to Deftones, and thank you for listening to Change in the House of Pods.